This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 8th of November 2014 on Monocle 24.
Provocative, personal, and always in pink, One Magazine set the course for the post-millennial explosion in independent publishing. Full frontal imagery and making the most of the male body, we speak to one editor who discovered that you can put anything you want in print and still be commercial. This week on The Stack, we speak to the creator of a publishing and men's lifestyle phenomenon. From the gay fringe, printing the show and tell of a very particular set of men, to much respected editorial and visual content. We sit down with Butt Magazine's Gert Jonkers and take a look at his new book.
We added a few pictures. I mean, the whole book is black and white, apart from some red pages. Wolfgang Tillmans wrote an introduction to the book, and Paul Flynn did an interview with The Open Eye.
Plus, we get another first look as we go behind the covers of the new issue of So It Goes with its editor and creative director James Wright. All that and plenty besides on The Stack, Monocle's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. We'll be joined by James Wright a little later in the show, but before that, we'll hear a special interview with the founder of influential magazine, Butt. From its inception in 2001, Butt set out to offer a finely tuned, carefully designed approach to alternative gay lifestyle stories. Far from just including full frontal nudity, Butt embellished and celebrated naked men and matched the images with in-depth revelatory interviews. Butt managed to attract big advertisers and some say even fostered a new attitude towards magazine publishing, as well as a trend for sporting a beard. Editor Gert Jonkers and creative director Jop van Bennekom went on to launch Fantastic Man and then The Gentlewoman, titles which continue to shake the world of fashion publishing to its very core. Butt Magazine's interview format and free-reined editorial approach remains influential, and to celebrate that, Tashin has just printed a hardcover anthology of some of the best of the A5 size light pink title. Forever Butt is the book's name, and a little earlier, David Pleasant sat down with Gert Jonkers to take a look through and have a look back at a legend of print.
Gert Jonkers, thank you for joining us on the publication of Butt Forever, this wonderful book. Can you first tell us why another book? We have had a Butt book before. Mm-hmm. This is, all it has to be said, more substantial, heavier. But why have you gone for this?
Well, the first Butt book came out in 2006, so that's incredibly long ago. And we realized that we did a lot after that. I mean, we made the book with Tashin in 2006. After, I think, 16 issues, but we've made 14 more issues after that and a couple of calendars, and we have the website where we interview people on. So it made sense to make another book.
And that kind of charted the sort of rise and rise of Butt in kind of cultural terms, would you say? So even with the Butt book that was published back then, it still had that zine feeling, even the book. It wasn't hardcover. Mm. It was more of a compilation of, as you say, the 16 issues before that. Mm. Now we're at, you know, that's the book. It's, mm-hmm. it's a different animal, would you say? Butt is more of a kind of historical reference point almost. It's not dead in any way, but how have you charted the kind of what Butt means since that?
It kind of got a little bit more monumental, also in our own memory or in our own perception. You know, you sometimes think that the longer things are ago, the better they are. But we actually realized that we did a lot of good things since the book came out. And so, you know, the Gore Vidal interview is there. And I mean, there's some old highlights, but I was just flipping through because we just received the first copy. And I was excited about how many recent things there are in there. I almost forgot.
So it still feels fresh to you?
It's super fresh to us, yeah, definitely.
And I wanted to kind of ask you about that. A whole kind of new level of different spectre of publishing has happened to you since Butt started. But what does Butt mean to you? Is it still a relevant kind of reference point? I mean, is it kind of like the crazy gay uncle that you might call for advice? Is it that kind of relationship?
Yeah, sometimes. I think it's very much almost the basis of the things we still do with Fantastic Man and The Gentlewoman and the other projects that we do is that, you know, it's basically just about the desire to meet people and sort of run into somebody and think like, wow, I would love to have a 2-hour conversation with this person. Or sometimes you do have a 2-hour conversation with somebody on a plane or in a train or in a bar. And it is always that desire. You know, maybe things we do in Fantastic Man are slightly more sophisticated, if you like, or we try out different formats, whereas But, you would, could say, was 90% just Q&A. But it's very dear to our hearts, and it's always that kind of reality that we keep, well, going back to, I wouldn't say, but it's just, you know, it's very much us, I think.
You've obviously had to choose, you make some decisions as to what, which people, which interviews, which images to feature. Were there kind of long nights with all the issues there in front of you, lots of printouts of all the pages of all the issues? How did it work?
There was maybe one long night with all the issues, and we, I think we all made a long list, Jop and I, and we worked with Carl, our assistant on the book. The three of us, we looked at it and sort of said like, okay, well, let's try this. And then we actually started making dummies or just like piles of paper, and we would sort of sift through the piles of paper and think like, that really doesn't work together. Or we were just looking for a form also. You know, the first book was anti-chronological, I would say. It sort of started with the most recent issue that we had out then, number 16 or 17, and went back to the first issue. This one's alphabetical because it just felt, I don't know. We toyed around a lot with what should the order be? What should the selection be? I mean, I think we had at some point a pile of 1,500 pages, and that couldn't possibly be a handy book. So we had to cut a lot, and we had to add in something again then because it didn't feel like the ultimate book yet. So, you know, it was a couple of weeks of going back to it and looking at it and being critical and being harsh and finishing it.
Here's the result.
We added a few pictures. I mean, the whole book is black and white, apart from some red pages. Wolfgang Tillmans wrote an introduction to the book, and Paul Flynn did an interview with Jop and I.
How interesting has it been for you to see, there's kind of two tangents going on. There's the independent publishing that's kind of exploded since But came on the scene. And also there's a change in the way that the bigger, let's say, glossy titles approach perhaps nudity, very frank conversations or attitudes to certain lifestyles or kind of different worlds, scenes. Do you kind of feel like But was really ahead of its game back then?
Yeah, we kind of look at it like that. I think people were honestly surprised. I mean, we were surprised that people were surprised about the frankness of the magazine and the directness. I mean, we just wanted to make a very real and direct magazine. And it was just funny to see how many people responded to it and how you could suddenly see newspapers do more Q&As. I mean, it's such a simple and proven format in a way that it's kind of weird that we forgot about it. So, I mean, I think that's just fascinating. But I do think it sparked a lot of people to do that again. And the whole zine thing, I mean, it's flattering and exciting to think that they came out somehow out of what But did. I mean, I hope we did that because it's a great movement. And, you know, if we could be responsible for that, that'd be amazing.
What people often say is that But was kind of allowed to have that content and allowed to maybe kind of penetrate the kinds of worlds that you wouldn't think it would or should, maybe because of the fantastic design and cleverness of the publication. When you were doing it from issue one, did you have that in mind? Did you think, I want women to like this? I want people who never read this or not typically interested in this sort of world to pick this up and really respect it? Was that a kind of conscious decision, or was it, I want to offer them something? What was going through your head? Because it seems like a conscious kind of planned out, when you look at issue one, when you hold it, it doesn't feel rough and ready. Actually, it feels very sort of well thought out.
I mean, it was very well thought out, I think, in the sense that we worked quite a long time on the first issue in order to get it right the way we wanted it. I can only speak for myself that I didn't really have an idea whether people would like it or not. I mean, it wasn't the grand plan from Jop to conquer the world with it or so, because we just didn't know. I mean, we really thought like, oh, let's make a magazine that we want to make. We're critical people, so we did it the best we could, and we did it as perfect as we could make it at that time. I think the first issue, we printed 750 copies of it, thinking if they don't sell, that's not a terrible loss. You know, we can manage that financial loss and we'll make a bonfire with it one night if we are stuck with them all.
Did you? You didn't need to, did
no,
you?
No, we didn't need to. No. I mean, I think we have one or two copies left in the office, and sometimes we're scared that we can't find them anymore. It was exciting that people recognize it, but I think it's great that women really responded to butt as well, which is something we really wouldn't have expected, I think. You just can't tell.
And talking about conquering the world, we've talked about the kind of influence on the world of publishing, on magazines, but then on the world gay scene as well, it seems that butt has been deeply influential in the way people dress or the way people should see themselves. The impact over the last decade or more has been profound.
Hmm.
When we were talking before about when you might have a new issue of butt, and rightly, you're pretty vague about that. You don't know when or if. But if you do, it was never intentionally trendsetting. But what are you trying to teach or say about the gay scene next? You've kind of covered it. Or you're so influential, it's quite difficult to know what you might do next.
Yeah, you want me to be the oracle for the next 10 years here? Well, I couldn't answer that because we're not planning an issue right now, although we do things on the website. It would be crazy to think that the fact that every man is wearing a beard these days is somewhat related to a small fanzine started out of Amsterdam. You know, I sometimes hardly can believe that, you know. So, and maybe people would have been wearing beards also if but wouldn't have existed. I mean, you can't really tell. I mean, I think it definitely had an influence. It definitely had an influence on the gay scene worldwide. To us, it was kind of shocking to realize after 15 issues or so, that if we would do a party where a lot of readers would gather, that it actually started to become quite clony again, or it started to look same-ish, which we never intended.
And there is that kind of stereotypical...
The butt guy, yeah. You know, which we don't really want to promote. I mean, we're not against anything, but it's not like, you know, it shouldn't be a clique. I think the importance of the magazine is that a lot of things can fit in. We never believed in a lifestyle because the lifestyle suggests that it's sort of like, you know, there is a kind of style guide, and there wasn't for butt. So what should it be right now? I don't know. I saw the Ryan Trocarten show in Berlin that's currently up at Kunstwerke, and it's, you know, it's very queer right now, I think. I mean, he was quite early on in butt. I think he's in the book as well.
I just wanted to ask you as well, I mean, it seems a bit strange to talk about the world of commerce and money to end, but what is also fascinating about butt is how it managed to engage advertisers early on or straight away, and that's kind of become a model or not for other independent titles. How do you think you were able to get those big advertising spreads, whether it's American Apparel or other brands, were so keen to engage with you? It seemed like it didn't feel like butt was begging them for money. It was almost the other way around at some point. It was they really wanted a piece of you. How did that come about? Was it because of the design, because you engaged the right sort of people?
I think, you know, because it looked very good and it spoke to people very much. We were very excited to have advertisement like Gucci and Dior and Marc Jacobs, just out of the perverse idea of it. It wasn't logical to have them as advertisers, that idea in itself was exciting to us. I mean, somebody once said to me, this straight friend of mine, who said, like, well, the whole magazine is about excitement. And it's true. And so being able to have those ads in the magazine, you know, I mean, it was great because it actually paid for the printing and it enabled us to continue it for years. It was very much the excitement of it. And I think people felt that, the advertisers felt that as well. And it was always interesting to see that we could only get ads if the designer or the owner of the brand wanted it. Because, of course, you know, if you would go the normal route of a media agency and so on, they would never dare to propose it to their client. You know, maybe they'd be shocked or offended if their agency would say, like, oh, I think you should be in this magazine. So it always had to be the other way around. And that was always a very interesting process.
I mean, the Tom Ford advert with the perfume bottle kind of strategically placed in someone's buttocks. Hmm. I mean, that was really, I can't think of another advert like it then since.
And I'm sure it was shot especially for the magazine because, you know, that he shot that campaign with Terry Richardson, and I'm sure they were there thinking, oh, that's hilarious, let's do that and let's put that in Butt.
That was David Pleasant talking to founder and editor of the legendary Butt magazine, Gert Jonkers. You're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. We'll be taking a look at the latest issue of So It Goes magazine with its editor here in Studio One right after this.
The idea behind The Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story, sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Now on The Stack, we're joined by James Wright, who after a career doing, well, just about everything at practically every media outlet you can think of around London and the globe, James settled down to produce, edit and provide creative direction to So It Goes, a discreetly stripped-back publication that shows the very best of contemporary art, journalism, trends and more. We have issue 4, hot off the press, right here with us. James, welcome back to The Stack. Good to have you with us, as
Thanks
always.
Thanks very much for having me.
Very hot off the presses on Newsstand this week. Tell me, issue 4, does it get any easier?
I'd love to say the answer is yes, but if anything, it's been harder than ever. But the results are inevitably, in all of that hard work paying off and seeing it go onto newsstands, it's an incredibly rewarding feeling. And then the according feedback that's hopefully positive that trickles round.
Oh, surely it doesn't trickle round. I bet it's a veritable tidal wave of praise. Tell us a little bit about 4. I mean, obviously, it's always interesting watching the kind of evolution of magazines, particularly magazines that we like. Will there be things that sort of strike people as very different, or is it kind of been this nice kind of a gradual, an evolution really, I guess, maybe more than anything else?
Yeah, I describe it as evolution more than revolution, certainly. We've retained the very specific chapterized structure of the magazine. So there are 7 chapters across the arts, one that touches on film, one music, one art, and so on. And in terms of the tone, it blends the long-form journalism that's very important to us with original photographic content. So we've tinkered with the design a bit, but it's a question of continuity, I guess. We want to keep pushing the form issue to issue. That's very important to us. But equally, that level of consistency hopefully delivers that fusion of journalism and photographic content that readers have reacted well to in the past and they can keep returning to over and over again.
And just in terms, I've sort of alluded to your polymathic tendencies. How easy is it to retain that discipline if you're sort of doing the oversight? You're also, of course, shooting a lot of the shoots yourself. Do you sort of revel in the fact that it's a multifaceted, your involvement in it? Or do you sometimes think, oh, I could probably do with doing one thing less, at least for this issue?
This issue has actually been incredibly exciting because I've had the opportunity to shoot one of the covers and one of the musicians that we shot in New York this summer. In the past, it's been a hobby, but obviously this is a platform to be able to indulge a hobby. And yes, of course, at times one wishes that you have greater resources and be able to delegate. But the fact is, we're all control freaks and it's very difficult to let go of that control. So, of course, yeah, at times it's testing. It's a small team. We're trying to achieve features that the likes of another and, you know, even the big Condé Nast titles also trying to go for. So we aim high and make life hard for ourselves occasionally, but hopefully we get there in the end.
In terms of sort of not just obviously with this sort of flagship title, but, you know, the other work that happens out of the sort of beneath the So It Goes umbrella, you're still very much convinced that that's the way ahead, that it works having, you know, the magazine within this sort of broader stable. I mean, we have a brand here at Monocle that does the same kind of thing. It's still the right way for you?
I think so. Sadly, in this day and age, despite the purple patch that, you know, we're going through with independent publishing, I don't think you can afford to just be a magazine. The creative agency financially underwrites what we do with the magazine, and oftentimes one arm feeds the other. There's an opportunity to do something with an interesting artist or director or actor. With that opportunity comes the ability to make a film or a piece of branded content. And in the coming year, we're looking to expand on the film screening series that we started this summer. So we brought over a filmmaker from Sundance and screened showing at the ICA. And that's something that's very dear to us. Film was one of the pillars upon which the magazine was founded. And having the ability to do that and bring a film that won't have been seen by British audiences as a result of the opportunities afforded us by the magazine, is something we very much want to carry on doing, for sure.
And there's some really great writing, I should say, about movies, and some, you know, some really lovely illustration and stuff in your direct and your film section. Just thought I'd mention that. That's my personal take from my first read. You've got also, James, an impressive stack of magazines, which you were, I think, is it safe to say, delighted to be carrying with you today to bring in. Should we dive into your stack? Where would you like to begin?
I've got a magazine here that one should only really term a magazine very loosely, because it mirrors what you'd call a coffee table book. I guess it's hardback, quite large format, and it's called Desillusion. It says on the spine, issue 47, tome 3, and I don't quite know what that means. I have no idea how long it's been around or whether it's an annual. Can't have been going for 47 years. But it's ostensibly a magazine about skating and surfing and snowboarding. But really, it seems to be a lot more than that. That's the springboard and the platform around which the broader stories pivot. It doesn't have any cover lines. It doesn't even have the title of the magazine on the front. It has an imprint of a skateboarder under a sculpture in Paris with the title No Other Love. And it just seemed to be a very bold piece of publishing. It really struck me. I was at Wardour Street News today, lost in a sea of magazines. And as ever, the choice is so overwhelming, but this one really caught my eye. And it seems extremely sure of itself. There's a great range of stories told, and the layout is very bold and imaginative, and it's something that really caught my eye.
Well, let's maybe delve inside and let's kind of have a leaf through. Because, as you said, it's, I guess, unorthodox, to say the least. And maybe that's something we associate with, I don't know, skate culture, that slightly kind of countercultural movement. But it's interesting, as you say, I mean, even just from a brief glance, it's very... there's a lot of kind of, what would you call them, sort of traditional approach. There's a lot of kind of white on black, black and white, some really nice monochrome spreads. It's kind of maybe more, I don't know, traditional than perhaps you would expect?
Yeah, I mean, there are elements that kind of touch on the zine-y. It's got that kind of counterculture spirit to it, I guess. But equally, you can tell that there's a level of involvement from brands, but it's done in a very subtle way. And not to say that people are being hoodwinked by it, but I think the way they fuse the brand's involvement is done in a very considered and thoughtful way. It's not ramming it down your throat in any way. The brand does have a presence, but in no way is it screaming from the page. So yeah, I think it's one to keep an eye on. Yeah, for
definitely,
sure.
And it's got heft on
its side.
It does. No doubt about it.
My shoulders That's aching a heavyweight, from carrying it around.
Heavyweight title, no doubt. Let's continue. Where should we go next?
I should mention that one is also dual language. So it's French, but one column is French, and then you have English side by side. And completely by chance, I've picked out another one that's dual language, run from Italy, which is called Muse Magazine. One thing that I've noticed with So It Goes over the past 6 months, certainly, is that the term general interest is a deeply unfashionable one. And with this boom in independent publishing, I've noticed that there's a specificity that comes with lots of the titles that are spoken about, whether it's craft, whether it's food, whether it's travel. And to be a broader church is something that there's a level of kind of negative connotation that comes with that, that you're not specifying about a particular subject. So Muse is one that I do think straddles that kind of cross-cultural remit very well. Produced out of Italy, but it's also English language. And there's beautifully imaginative photography, but also that fusion, like we try and accomplish with long-form writing, something that you can really get lost in. And I hold my hand up in that I'm probably behind on my magazine reading. And it's only times like today when I go out and seek them out and hopefully at some point take a holiday. I'll be taking these magazines with me because there's a richness of content in titles that I wouldn't ordinarily read, I wouldn't ordinarily pick up. They're not favourites of mine. But having had the chance to look at the newsstand today, that's one that sprung out again.
Did you find that your eye is led by, I mean, I often ask this of guests on the stack, is it about arresting covers, something like Muse? Are you interested in the approach that comes from a publication that appears in two languages? Or are you interested in, you're drawn to titles that maybe, as you said about So It Goes, cover this broader remit? Do you tend to sort of gravitate towards a sector even? You mentioned that the wealth of options is sometimes too vast. How do you sort of refine your selections?
I think to say that we as consumers don't take into account the way a cover looks is obviously misleading. Supposedly the science is that you make up your mind within 3 seconds having your eye caught by a cover or not. I have no idea whether there's any truth in that. But I wouldn't say I'm led by my choice to buy a magazine by the cover necessarily. But what we try and do is, I guess, a non-traditional take on celebrity portraiture. It's not a headshot locked off, eyes to camera. It's a way of getting a different tape on a very well played out type of photography. So cover choice comes into it. But I guess my next title is The Economist. And that's one that I will always go to when I'm traveling or at the airport, I guess, because I will have time to catch up, much like The Week, I think I brought it in last time. It's a digest of everything that you will have missed if you don't have the chance to read the daily newspaper, if you get your news digitally. You're able to delve into a story, and they do what they do, and they're comfortable with that. They're not trying to push the form. They accept they are copy heavy. They don't make any inroads into photographic exploration. And so I guess titles like Muse and my last title, Another, the latest issue which just came out, titles that can fuse those two things. It can have cultural and political commentary, but it can also have beautifully produced photo shoots. Mm. That marriage is something I'm always attracted to.
We'll talk about Another in just a second, but we're talking about The Economist, and it's interesting, it strikes me when you say, oh, if I'm traveling, I'll always pick this up. A lot of people say, well, hang on, if you want some, you know, some analysis and some, you know, slightly shorter form journalism, you know, you can have that on your tablet. You can get that, you can just download that. Mm. And I'm reassured, frankly, by the idea that you'll still look for it on the printed page. Do you think that there's still, therefore, you know, a role to be played for titles that cover even, you know, more topical stuff, and it doesn't have to be off a cold and uninvolving screen?
Myself, like most other people nowadays, will always click onto The Guardian or BBC News on their iPhone or tablet, and that's the way that we're able to engage with what's going on in the world. But equally, I think if you do have time, as we all do, if we wanted to make time, we can do, but when we go away, I like being able to pick up The Economist or Monocle and dive into these stories with greater depth. And I think you'll always be able to do that by engaging with print as opposed to digital. Your mind simply isn't able to absorb the information, or at least mine isn't, in the same way as if I was reading off a printed page.
That's the correct answer. Let's very briefly then look at Another. You mentioned that as your sort of final selection. Another heavyweight volume. You're clearly working out this week.
Yeah, I think this is about 600 pages or something ridiculous. This is a title that I've visited over the years, and obviously it's part of the Dazed and Confused group, which Jefferson Hack started back with Rankin, I think when he was 19 years old. And it's just stunning, this one. The range of photographic content is so strong. But it's the little tidbits in this issue which really caught my attention. There's a section where you have various kind of luminaries across photography, fashion, film and art. And it's entitled Another Thing I Want to Tell You. And it's a very small snippet where it will get Buzz Aldrin talking about scuba diving. It will get Julie Verhoeven talking about Elmo, the Sesame Street character. And there's something very playful and knowing about it. But because it's bite-sized as opposed to a lot of the other copy in the magazine, I think it's immediately eye-grabbing and imaginative. I haven't seen many other magazines who do that. They highlight a particular celebrity or someone who they deem a cultural influencer, but get them to talk about something that's completely unrelated to what they're known for, which I thought was great.
Great stuff. That's a nice upbeat note on which, sadly, we have to end, James. That's the end of our... Well, it was a fast and furious roll through some of your favourite magazines, heavyweight title selections that you had. James Wright, thanks very much for coming to see us. Best of ongoing luck with the latest issue of So It Goes, which is as good as ever. And we'll catch up with you again very soon on The Stack, hopefully.
Thanks very much for having me.
That does indeed bring us to the end of this edition 115 of The Stack with me, Tom Edwards. A special thanks to my guest, James Wright, and I should remind you to pick up the latest edition of So It Goes magazine, in particular, extraordinary piece in there, an interview with Mario Testino, no less, and James and his team also had access to Testino's extraordinary archive, well worth checking out. Thanks too to my producer, David Pleasant, and of course, our studio manager, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as always. info@monocle.com is where you should direct them. And don't forget to join us again next Saturday at the very same time. You can also catch up at monocle.com or via iTunes or SoundCloud. For now, though, from me, Tom Edwards, and this edition of The Stack, that is all. Goodbye.